on why every child challenges the authority of the parent. This is very, very important. Why does every child does challenge the authority of the parent? Some children are strong-willed. The Lord was kind of preparing me, I think, for teaching this kind of stuff, because in our four children, we had both the classic strong-willed child and the classic compliant child. LeAngela, our oldest, some of you know LeAngela, she was the textbook strong-willed child. That is, LeAngela, you could tell her not to touch something, and she knew she wasn't supposed to touch it. Every once in a while, she would check. She'd look. I've had LeAngela do this. She'd look you right in the eye. Eric, have a kid do this. Look you right in the eye, and just put their finger right up next to it, and just look at you. What are you going to do about it? And then they would touch it. I spanked LeAngela five times in a row. That was my world, my record, five times. And I'd done it six. I'd done it nine. I mean, she'd look at you, and just, I'd see you make it. Strong will. Now, a lot of strong will children end up in prison or in real trouble. I'm very serious. Strong will child is like a high powered rifle. It depends on which direction you get them aimed in. And the secret to a strong will child is to break their will without breaking their spirit. Strong will children, if you break their will without breaking their spirit, tend to become super achievers. They will do all kinds of things just to show you or to show themselves. Very strong will. LeAngela was a super achiever. Her list of credits as long as your arm. She just determined she's going to do something. But every so often, she'd come around and just take a lot of spanking. Aaron, on the other hand, my oldest son, now Leslie was somewhere in between. Leslie, my oldest son, when he was born, he was exactly the opposite. Aaron, my oldest son. I mean, when he was that age, I could point my, he could write a book on how to repent. I mean, I just put my finger out or snap my fingers, and have I offended you? You just see this in his eyes. Oh, I would never. You don't want me to touch it? I'll go in the next room. I'll never come near it again. I mean, you could give him one, and he'd last for 6 months. I thought, man, there's nothing to raising boys. All you got to do is point your finger at him, and then came Adam. God's first and my last. Adam wasn't quite as bad as Aaron, whereas Aaron would melt when I'd point my finger at him. Adam would give me the shoulder. Just, you know, shoulder, give his raise the shoulder. Define who you think you are. And Adam was still in diaper. It just took us 3 months to figure out who was the head of the house and who wasn't. He's been great ever since. But, you know, he'd give me this, and make put that shoulder down. You know, look at you. They're all different. But every child, whether they're the strong-willed child, as few children are, or the compliant child, as few children are, or the children in the middle, who are a little bit of both, as most children are, they will challenge the authority of the parent. Now, Dobson says it's because of original sin. We'll get into that. His version of original sin, I don't know of any theologian that holds his particular view. He says God created them that way. Well, that's not, most people who hold original sin don't hold that. But anyway, it's not because of original sin. And let me give you my analogy. Let me teach this by analogy. Suppose you, in some kind of hypothetical science fiction world, universe, all of a sudden found yourself plopped down on an alien planet. You didn't know where you were. You just sort of there, appeared. And the only thing you knew is that you were the smallest, weakest thing around. In your world, this alien world, you were the smallest, weakest thing there. How would you feel? What kind of baby is? They sort of show up, and all they know is they're the smallest, weakest thing around. In this analogy, there's a jungle out there, or a forest. And in it, you hear sounds. If you don't know what you're hearing, you don't know whether you should be afraid or not, but you're afraid simply because you don't know. The Germans have a word for it called Angst. You get a word, anxiety. It's unnamed fear of an unnamed object. The children feel this anxiety. And you see shapes moving, but you don't know what you're seeing. How would you feel? Well, you'd be afraid, wouldn't you? You don't know whether you should be afraid, but you're afraid simply because you don't know. But fortunately, in this little science fiction dream, there's a fence around you. This fence protects you from whatever it is out there. But you see, the parents, and as you've already guessed, the parents are the fence. You're the fence. Now, what would you do ever so often if you were in this alien world? The only thing protecting you from whatever is out there, which is causing you to be afraid. What would you do ever so often? Well, my question is vague, so I'll answer it myself. Ever so often, you'd push on the fence. You'd test the fence. Why? Well, you see, when you push, you'd push against the fence. Now, listen to me. When you pushed against the fence, what would be your hope? What would you want? Would you want the fence to fall over or to not fall over? A superficial logic might say, if you don't want the fence to fall over, why push on it? But you see, you push on in the hope that it won't. Because the fence is the only thing protecting you from whatever's out there. And so you want to make sure you're safe. What would happen in this little dream if you walked over to the fence one day and you pushed on and it fell over? How would you feel? What would you lose? You lost your security. In other words, if this fence is the only thing protecting you, and you're stronger than the fence is, and you're the weakest thing you know of, that is, you lose your security. If the fence cannot protect, keep you in, it cannot keep whatever's out there out. Now, a strong-willed child will push on the fence four or five times before breakfast. A compliant child will push on it once a month. Most children somewhere in between, but every child tests the fence. And you see, when our children challenge our authority, now learn this, when a child openly defies or challenges the authority of the parent, the issue is security. They're asking a question, are you tough enough to take care of me? When a child challenges you, he's trying to find out if he's safe or not. Am I safe? And one of the most distressing, discouraging things for a child is to find out that he or she is stronger than the parent. There's this clash of the will, and the will of the child prevails. And they don't want it to prevail. They don't want the fence to fall. And hear me, the fence doesn't have to fall every day. It doesn't have to fall every time, I mean. It has to fall once or twice. See, that's why when a child throws a tantrum and you change the subject, the child knows he or she's not supposed to have something, and they just reach out. They don't really want it. They want to know, are you tough enough for me to trust? That's what they're asking. And they need an answer. And it's your responsibility to make sure they get one. A good, clear answer. That makes sense to you? And children who know, listen to me, children who know, go back to my original language, and learn this, children who know that the fence is not going to fall down are children who are free and happy. And they can go on. But you'll see this. You'll see a kid in the supermarket, a baby, an infant, and the mother puts it, very small child, puts it in the basket, and the mother walks down the aisle to get something. And the child thinks that he's alone. What's that child? That child won't panic. Why? No fence. But you let the mother pick that child up. You see a mother carrying an infant? Look at, you can carry it down at Disney. There can be noises and there can be all kinds of moving large shapes. Now, I'll bet you there. Why? It's got no blood. It's got mother. It's panic. You see, that's why a child panics really in its soul when they push on the fence and the fence falls down. Children, and listen, children understand that and they want that. Even when they get older, you know, an 8-year-old boy will do. An 8-year-old boy has a daddy who's a wimp. He'll lie about it. He'll make up a daddy that isn't a wimp. He'll say, "Boy, you can't fool my dad. You can't push my dad around. You know, doing all he can." But he wishes he couldn't. When a teenager says, Well, I got to be home by 11:30. Wow, my dad's only home at 11:30. When he says he's home at 11:30, I got to be home at 11:30. The teenager who says that is not ashamed to say that. We had one of the Angel's parents one time said, I wish my parents cared enough about me to make me be home on time. Their parents thought they were saying that their daughter free. They said, well, you're home there. Just use your own judgment. Home wherever you want to. And that child did not feel free. Dad, you coming up? I'm going to be home. I think the other way, Aaron told me last year, he said, Dad, just tell me when you're home. I said, you're getting old enough. You know our boundaries. You know how we feel. You're getting old enough to get home. It's time to get home. Well, Aaron, you just tell me. I'd say, no, I'm not going to tell you. I didn't say to him what I wanted to say, you're old enough to start, you're going to start being a fence one of these days, rather than pushing on the fence, and you need to learn to be a fence. But they desire that. They desire that kind of freedom that comes when the boundaries are very clear and they don't move. Does that make sense to you? Oh, listen. You know this? I've seen kids. My wife has kept small children, not regularly, but off and on, reminded her they reminded their own parents. And they were happier. Children will seek parents, an adult who are an unmovable fence. Now that has to be more complicated than that, but they act better. They're happier. Now, so that encourages us to be disciplinarian, does it not? That is, if you understand the issue, let me repeat that: when your child challenges your authority, they're asking this question: am I safe? Am I safe in this world? And boy, they like that. Okay. Now we come to the Dobbs. I list here, number 12, make room for healthy rebellion. Some rebellion is healthy. By that I mean the old phrase of cutting the apron strings. You don't regiment children. It's one thing to have obedient children, it's something else to have regimented children. And some rebellion is normal. By that I mean they have to become their own person. Our children are their own people. You do not impose your total personality and life on your children. For instance, my children have always worn clothes, some clothes I thought they shouldn't wear for all kinds of reasons. There's some music in our house, which we have a rule in our house: no rock music. Right? Listen, we don't permit rock music in the house. Now there's some music we agree on. We used to play a lot of the Carpenters, John Denver, and there's still a lot of kids' music I like. That's old. And some of the kids' music I like. Understand? There's that music that we all agree on, we like. There's that music which is not going to be in the house, because it's my house, and I'll decide. And they don't want it anyway. But there is that music which is in between. My kids play a lot of music I don't like, but it's a matter of taste. It's usually too loud, but I just think I turn it down. When I go in my house, I turn down the radio and it's not even on. It's a Pavlovian reaction. I say it's too loud even just as a reaction. And they know I don't like it. Do I have a right to say to my children? I have a right to say to my children, we have no hard rock music in this house. Do I have a right to say that? Yes. But do I have a right to say to my children, we're not going to have any of the music in this house if I don't like it? No. Why? They got their rights. They don't see the kind of music they like. As long as it doesn't violate our moral code, anything. And they've got a right to that. My kids, some of the clothes my kids have worn, I say, you going to wear that? Oh, Dad. Basically, I thought, are you going to wear that? Oh, Dad. We have to the script. But they've got a right. They've got a right to a point, in a sense, to be their own people. And sometimes they'll do it, they'll wear it just because you don't like them. They'll do things. Did you ever do this to your parents? Some kids wear it because they don't want to wear it because they know their parents don't like it. They're declaring their individuality. That's healthy. Listen to me. I want to be a parent. I do not want to be a cookie cutter. Well, they all come out the same. They have a right to their own life, up to a point.
Yes. That thing there about putting it on music, about music, one of the things that struck me when Tori and Mark and I talked about earlier was just their parenthood, fatherhood, and, you know, speaking more than whatever they want, he's healthy, and he's smart about it. One thing I do is ask them to calm down when they interview them, do you? Because it's worth the time, I said, no, every time he says, yeah, I just want to fly, my father's fall on his foot.
Yeah.
And that's along those lines.
Now that's not what I'm talking about. Yeah, open the rebellion. If I say turn it down, it gets turned down. But you understand, but there's a matter of taste. Children have a right. For instance, my boys wanted to play soccer. I didn't want them to play soccer because I didn't know anything about soccer. But that was their choice. And they played soccer for, I got to like it. So I didn't like it. It wouldn't have been my choice. But you understand? I didn't have a right to say, I never played soccer, you're not going to play soccer. No, they've got a right to be their own people. Make room for it. Listen, if you don't make room for healthy rebellion, you're going to get the unhealthy kind. Okay, does that make sense to you? Here are adoption, six primary steps in good discipline. I'm going to read these, and we'll go on. Define the boundaries before they are enforced. Your kids have a right to be told ahead of time what's expected of them, not after the fact. Secondly, the parent must always win when the boundaries are challenged, or indecisively. Distinguish between willful defiance and childish irresponsibility. We've said that. Reassure and teach the child after the confrontation. Avoid impossible demands. For instance, let me give you an idea of a possible demand. Take a four-year-old kid to church, make him sit up in the pew and listen for the, and sit there for an hour and be quiet. That is unreasonable. It's cruel and unusual punishment. It's impossible. Why? Kids can't do that. They're not built like that. I've seen parents do that and end up raising a kid who hates church. We always kept our kids with us on Sunday night. And my wife, for years and years, she had a separate bag for church. We had crayons and all kinds of things, little girl. And later on, for the boys, the little matchbox fires. I still believe if I take my wife's purse and look far enough into the bottom, you'd find three things: a matchbox car, a little plastic baggie with a wet washcloth in it, always had the washcloth, and some, Cheerios, only they're sugared, Fruit Loops, little things like that. And so the kids, when the little kids were growing up, what you do, they'd get down, and they could get down on the knees in the pew. You don't want to stand up and wave at the people behind you, you know, or run around. You know, never let them run. But, you know, they listen for a while, and they tell her for a while. And they listen for a while, or they get down and play with their cards. And nobody knew what they were doing. And then gradually, as the years passed by, they played less and listened more. And they got used. And our kids get very, with a very positive attitude toward church. You see, when the kid gets to be 12 or 13 years old, are you going to say, let's go to church? They say, oh, no, church. Or are they going to say, yeah, enjoy it. Positive thing. You see, you don't make impossible demands. I just use that as an example. To make a child act like an adult and not an adult is unreasonable. Yeah, it become uncontrollable. You can't deal with other people. You can't control other people's kids too much. But just make them go sit and, yeah. You can't intimidate them. You can't buffalo them. You ask the Christian education people on that. I don't want to get into that. That's a good question. I just don't want to get into it. I'm just saying. All I want to say here is that, you know what the unreasonable demand is? Expect a child to act like a 12-year-old when a kid's only 3 or 4. That's not reasonable. Let love be your guide. And now, ask the question you raised earlier. What about controlling a child in public? Here's the rule. Never publicly humiliate a child. You're fishing with a golden hook. It is not worth it. But never allow a public situation to be used as a weapon against you. Some kids pick their parents in public, and they use their public situation like a club. They will do what they would not normally do because they know that the parent doesn't want to challenge them. Now, how do you handle children in public? You never humiliate a child, never spank a child in front of other people. It is not worth it. What you gain is not worth what you lose. Yes. Take them out. Yes, they got to be spanked. Take them out behind the building, spank them, let them get their crying over with, then bring them back in. But it's better to work it out ahead of time. Listen to me. I'm going to tell you what I believe, and this works. It's true. If you have proper control of your children, listen, you can't do anything. You can't love, you can't teach if there's no control. There has to be control. And if your children are under control, you can control them in public. You know, I told you Adam about this, yes or no, I put him in a chair. This sort of, without my planning for it being so, this worked out to be our signal, our public signal. If we were going to a gathering, it would be a picnic or something, we'd tell the kids ahead of time what we expected of them. But the kids do it with other kids, they get, the adrenaline starts to flow, they get carried away. And I could call them over and say, I whisper yes or no. Nobody else, most of the people didn't even hear me. I said, it's the Leslie. They don't know what you mean, if they did hear it, to other people. Kid's not embarrassed. What it means is, now I told you what I expected of you, you're not doing it, and I'm noticing it, and when we get home, we're going to deal with it if you don't straighten up. So, and they would say, so what I'm asking you now is yes or no, are you going to obey me or not? I want to know right now, because when we get home, we're going to do business. And they usually say yes, and that's all they need. You understand? It helps them control themselves, and they didn't get humiliated. There's also the eye during the church. Let's say, tell them about the eye.
I was talking to me and my friend about 5, 6, 7, we were talking. How many old time in the front screen was 39 at first, right? And he did a statue and he was taking him. And he was trying out and doing that people were there. And I knew, I knew he did. And he called me up after church, he told me to go home. He was waiting for him. And he was like,
you have fellas, you children under control. In a public situation, you'll be able to clear your throat or snap your finger, you can absolutely control your children. It works. You can do it. And what it does, let me tell you, what it does, it makes room for fun. I went out to eat. I remember one time when I took my family out on Friday night, our family night to eat. And we had a table next to us. There was one child and 4 adults. And those 4 adults spent their whole evening trying to get that one little girl in a chair. I almost went over and volunteered to help. I felt like I don't understand. You all notice that you're bigger than she is? And I'll tell you what, I bet you the next Friday night that kid stayed home with the babysitter. He got left behind. Why? Because there was no control over that child. It was a set of parents and a set of grandparents, I think. Maybe an aunt thrown in. Together, I mean, they would threaten, they would beg, they would reason with the child. All she needed was to be thumped on the head. That's all she wanted. And just clear the air. But let me tell you something. I'm serious about it. We had 4 kids. I could take my 4 kids to the nicest restaurant, and we've done. We go to the nicest restaurant with other adults around, and. You could sit there and tell stories and tell jokes and express love and have a great family time because there was control. I had to spend no time trying to get them to obey or stay in their chair or anything. You understand? You see, discipline makes room for love. If you don't have control, you can't do anything. You can't pass on your values to your kids. You can't enjoy them. You can't laugh at their jokes. All you're trying to do is keep them off the wall. And I'm not making that up. I've seen situations. And you, if you have that kind of control, you can point a finger or give the eye or clear your throat, and they know that either your children are under your control or they aren't. And it is not an oppressive thing if it gives freedom. Everybody is free. I can't tell you how many delightful evenings out we spent in nice restaurants. You know, having adult kind of fun, enjoying. Because you don't have to worry about control. But if your kids are not under control, what happens is, when they get out in public, then they just go explode. But you don't discipline in public. You work out ahead of time. And if they get off, and if you have to spank a child, you take them out back and spank them in. Now, there will be situations, I realize, will be impossible. There's exceptions to every rule, but that's the general rule. You understand what I'm teaching you? It's not worth it. Do you like to be humiliated in public? Your kids are people. They don't like to be humiliated. They don't like it either. Okay. I've already, points 15 and 16 I've made. Let me go on to point 17. This is especially for fathers. Avoid the Sinai complex. Just because you have authority in the home and control doesn't mean you're God. I bet you, whenever I teach in churches, I will say this, there are older men present. I bet, and there may be some fellows here, and ladies too. There may be people here. If you were older, it would be certainly be true. There would be some here who could never remember their father apologizing, saying they were sorry, backing off. Listen to me. If you're a strong disciplinarian, I believe in being a strong disciplinarian, you're gonna mess up. You're gonna act sometime when you're mad, you're gonna act without before you get all the information, you're gonna do it wrong. And listen to me, it's one thing to be in charge of the house, it's something else to be God on Mount Sinai, where everything you say is written in stone, it cannot be changed, and it's divine revelation. It isn't. So what you have to learn is to say these three things. I'm sorry, I was wrong, and I don't know. You regularly have to go to your children and say, look, I'm sorry, I was wrong, I shouldn't have done that. It will not decrease the respect your children have for you, it will increase it. Because this, if you've made a fool of yourself, they know it. It's real, you always tell fellas, it gets real quiet in the house. I remember one time I came home and I was out of sorts and a couple of kids had done something, I forget what it was. Leslie was still only about six or seven at the time, maybe eight. And I'm telling you, I cleared the landscape. I grounded the whole family, the dog, and two of the neighbors. I mean, everybody was in sight. And I just really clamped down and then I cooled off and got the whole story. And it, you know, we got to supper and, you know, it's real quiet. They're just sitting there eating, nobody saying a word, you know. Deathly, you know. And so I said, I just say, did you all notice that when I walked in the door tonight that I made an absolute jackass out of myself? And Leandra, is the mouth, said, yes, Daddy, we noticed that. And I said, well, it's true, I did. And so I said, we're gonna scratch all that out and go back and deal with it realistically. You have to back off. Sometimes you spank the child, you have to go into the room and say, son, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have spanked you. I acted too quickly. And if you don't know, say you don't know. I mean, when the Angela started dating, she'd ask me all these questions about, you know, the rules. I said, honey, I don't know. This is your first time to be a teenager? My first time to have a teenager. We'll learn together. We'll make this rule, but we find out it doesn't work, we'll change it. You know, you don't stick to it just because you made it. And you may need to talk it over and make another rule. Understand? If you don't know, say you don't know. And if you did it wrong, say you were wrong. And if you're sorry, say so.
You never use the maybe I shouldn't spank you, but I probably owe you for a few.
Yeah, no. Yeah, no.
Which is probably true. That works both ways.
There are different father types. I wish I recommend you Samuel Osherson's book, Finding Our Fathers, The Unfinished Business of Manhood. He speaks of the angry father. Did you grow up with an angry father? God help the child who grows up with an angry father. whose memory of their father is, my dad was always mad. And that's very common. Judgmental fathers create sons who are always trying to get praise and never feeling as if they succeed. There's the weak father. I've already talked about this. Son, weak fathers earn the contempt of their sons. There's the all-suffering father. He's the martyr who puts himself in a grave, early grave, providing the family with more material goods than they really need. Then there's the heroic father who has a position of high visibility and respect. He's an idol, but these kids don't know him. They worship him, but they don't know him. I need to avoid all those pitfalls. But I rushed through that so I can get to this point. I realize we get today in one more double session. The other side of discipline is love, and I mean express love. Now look at this, students. I put the word express love in the syllabus because that's what I mean. The opposite of, remember I talked about the two kinds of authority, delegated is absolute, and the authority of the father and mother is absolute. Why do I obey? Because that's the way the system is. I'm the father and you're not. But the other side of absolute authority is express love. And the difference, and the other kind of love, the kind that will not work is assumed love. Okay? Express love stands in opposition to assumed love. What's assumed love? A lot of fathers raise their families on assumed love. I wonder how many students we have here. I don't want to see a show of hands. Especially boys who can't ever remember their father looking them right in the eye and saying, I love you. Or hugging them. Some people can't ever remember being hugged. Did our fathers love us? Yes. But it was assumed. Of course I loved them. Why? Would I pay the mortgage and bring home the groceries? You got that? Assumed love. The fathers hugged them when they were little, but by the time they get old enough to remember, they didn't do it. Now listen, if there ever was a day when assumed love, especially from fathers, was going to do the job, that day's over. It's been over for a long time. And if you were not raised, take my word for it, if you were not raised on expressed love, especially from your fathers, one of the hardest things you'll ever do is learn how to do it. You'll sweat blood learning how to do it. Remember Fonzie trying to say, I'm sorry, in happy days, I'm so, trying to apologize? That's how you'll be, tongue-tied. Take my word for it. But you got to learn. What's express love? It's the other side of this. If you're a strong disciplinarian, but you don't express love, you make your kids mean. And you'll kill the person. You'll raise sterile kids. By that I mean sterile of personality, emotionally dead. On the other hand, you can be just a sentimentalist if there's no authority. The proper balance that we need. What's express love? The need for physical contact with both mother and father. Children need it. Fellas, do you know that little girls have a deep psychological need to spend hours on their father's lap? We don't know why that is, but it's true. And children, mother and daughters who don't get this, they suffer from it psychologically. That's what the experts say. I think they're right. Little girls need to sit on daddy's lap by the hour. They want that. They need that. Little boys need to wrestle with daddy. You watch a little boy? They'll pick on you. One of my favorite uncles, he wasn't worth shooting otherwise, but I loved him dearly because he was the only one, when I teased him, he'd chase me, run me down, and tickle me. Little boys will challenge. You watch the little boys. I don't know why that is. Now, this is much more complex than that, but they need this contact. And you need, as they grow up, you need, I recommend this, every day, kissing and hugging and saying, I love you. As simple as that. Regularly. And boys need it just as much as girls.
What about death?
Jumped on that. Yeah, that too. You know, it's all kinds. I'm just talking about the special needs. Leslie, I'll tell you before, Leslie, she grew up wanting to be a horse. I probably got 4 or 5 miles in on my hands and knees. with Leslie on my back, you know, and they grab you. They need this physical contact, and they need it as they grow up. Listen, a 16-year-old needs it just as much as a 6-year-old, especially boys. Now, it's an amazing thing. I believe, I'll be very honest with you, I had to learn this. I believe in hugging. And listen, you know what a boy, a 13 or 14-year-old boy going to junior high school needs? He needs a daddy about every morning to grab him by the shoulders, whether he's up or down, and look him right in the eye and say, "Adam, you know your daddy loves you." Remember that all day. You're my kind of people. But you're a winner. You got what it takes. Go get them. The junior high world is a very vicious world. And they... Now, it's interesting. If you're going to hug and kiss, girls, they love it all the way through, your daughters, and they never stop. Because I don't do. Boys, when the hormones start to flow, puberty sets in. Something in the hormones or the culture tells them they're not supposed to like it. They like it, but they're not supposed to like it. The rule at our house is, and I'm very serious about this. And I've said this. The rule at our house is, I'm the father. It's my house. I'm the head of the house. If I say it's time to hug, it's time to hug. And if you don't like it, that's your problem. When you get your family, you can decide. Well, now I decide. And old daddy, you know. And when they get to be, when they start through puberty, the boys, I've chased the boys as much as 4 blocks. I don't care. It's time. Yeah. Now, run them down. And they love it, you know. Oh, here comes a tugging time. They'll start running, you know. And you're supposed to chase them. You know, they look back. They push you there. Now, when they get, the problem was, when my boys got older, they both run track, and they're very good at track. I can remember, it seemed like just yesterday, I'd go jogging, running, and they'd go with me. Daddy, can I go with you? And so on my track, I'd leave them off and pick them up on the way back. And now they leave me off and pick me up on the way back. Very humiliating. Now, you know, we have fellowship for the first 10 feet, and then they're gone, and they're back home already showered and watching television. I'm just coming in finally, but it doesn't bother me. See, I stay in shape, and the only thing you do, fellas, I'm very serious. When you get to be junior high on up, is what you do is you just grab them, and then you announce that it's hugging time. Once you got a hold of them, I ambush those suckers. And I'll grab them, you know, I'll just clamp down and say, "Guess what time it is? It's time to kiss your head." And we have it. Sometimes it takes four or five minutes of just hard wrestling just to get them down so you can kiss their head without getting your teeth knocked out. But I don't care. They need their head, and they don't care either. Interesting. They forget they're not supposed to. The funny thing, they forget what's not supposed to like it. One of my favorite memories is about 8 months ago, Aaron got off the call up on my lap, 6'2½. You should have seen that. That was a real trick. Aaron's through that now, and Adam's still in the middle of it. But they don't. They sort of tolerate you because there's something in the hormones of that. But I don't care. Since I'm tall, I believe in head kissing. I spend half my life getting hair out of my teeth. But they need it, understand? They may not respond to it, the teenage boy, but they need it and they like it. And if they gripe, I just say, "Well, you know, I don't care. I'm bigger than you are. You gripe away. I decide, not you." And they're glad. And let me tell you something. A part of this is involved in raising kids who are alive. You know, often we do this. We equate quiet kids with good kids. We'll say, "Well, that's a good kid. You never hear a word out of him." Well, he may just be sneaking up on you. Listen, some of the worst kids I've ever known were quiet, like a snake. And some of the best kids I've ever known were noisy. There's no connection, no necessary connection between being noisy and being good. What I want is kids who are turned on to life, who laugh when it's time to laugh and cry when it's time to cry, kids who are emotionally, a lot of kids today are emotionally sterile. They're turned off. I mean, they don't care about anything. Don't ever get excited about anything or really depressed about anything. They're just turned off. And you understand what I'm saying? You need kids who are turned on to life, to real life. I like it when I see a teenage boy cry when his sister comes home. He hasn't seen her for 6 or 8 months. That's good. You understand? Because that's the purpose. That's what you're supposed to do. Not be this cool, detached. Listen, I cannot stand that. This cool, detached spectator of life. We get a lot of Bible, a lot of our students here are like that, at least when they first come, and some are still like that. You know who they are. I mean, they wouldn't give their heart to anything. And they don't cause any trouble sometimes. Some of the kids in the youth group, they don't cause any trouble, not because they're good kids, but because they're dead. They've been raised emotionally sterile. And I don't want that. So express love. Do you buy this? It's a very simple thing. It didn't cost you anything. Yes. They have to learn later on. Yes, you can learn it. It's hard, though. Well, you see, often love is assumed. Love is there. It's just assumed. But hear me. We tend to raise our kids the way we were raised. And we're not critical of our parents. That's not our job. But listen, if anybody ever loved me, my dad loved me. He's a great sacrificer, really paid the price. But I taught him to hug. He hugs me now. Didn't have any choice because I got so much bigger than he is. I grabbed him and he started hugging. And a few years ago, he started hugging me back. And now on the telephone, I can say, "I love you, Dad," and he'll answer, "I love you too." He always felt that way. The love was always there, great love. You see, but he was raised that a man didn't express it to other men, to their sons. And it's not without thinking about it. My dad's a great man. And truly a great man in many very important ways. You understand? But it's a matter of what I'm saying is that our kids today, especially our sons as much as our daughters, they need the express kind of love. Yes?
You had mentioned before about crying. How does a person actually shed tears when you grow up that men don't cry?
Yeah. But you probably can't. You should teach your kids to. It's if they're taught to express their emotions in a general kind of way. If you've never been raised that way, you probably, it's hard.
My father, he still loves me. I hug him, kiss him, but he'll never, and I love him. He knows he did.
That's right.
But, physical contact is there, not the word.
Yes.
Do you think that's switching? Do you think that the kids today are realizing what they missed out on if they initiate getting their parents to express the type of love, and so they're going to be better parents?
I don't know. I think kids today, I think younger families are doing, our culture is changing. A lot of this is culture, product of our culture. It's changing a lot. I think we're gaining ground in some areas and losing ground in some others. We're gaining in that, losing in this one. But listen, here's the rule. Now listen to me. Discipline makes room for love, and love makes room for discipline. If a child, if you have control of a child, you can express love. If you love a child, you can discipline. The more, listen, if a kid knows that you love him, and you're telling him you love him, and you're hugging him, and you're telling him how much you like him, and you're building him up, you can come down on him as hard as ugly on an apron. You're not going to turn him off. You can just really discipline him. You have to, and they're going to buy it. I tell you, the kids that turn, see, a lot of fathers, they thought since they beat on their kids regularly, they were good fathers, good disciplinarians, and all the kids got was mean. Why? You get a kid, listen, you want to turn a kid off. You want to create a jailbird, especially a boy. All you do is, the only time you get him your full attention is when you're coming down on him, when you're in trouble. But if you've given them your full attention in a loving way, when the time comes when you have to focus in and clean house, they'll buy it. They'll understand it. And you're not going to make them mean. It's like they expect it. Okay, that's a very important principle. That's all for today. A parent. We're looking at K on page 30, the mother at home, and I have already talked about this enough that I can just give this the light touch here. I raised the question, the working mother, necessity or luxury? I think I said, did I not, when the question was raised, that the working mother sometimes is a necessity. Not always. And what is one person's necessity is not another person's necessity. But I teach the general principle that it is better for children to have a mother at home than it is to have things, if that is the choice. And what many people think are necessary are not all that necessary. You can get by without a whole lot of things. But children have a tough time getting by without mothers. I have discussed, have I not, with you, when it came up, the growing child care industry, and sometimes this meets a real need. It's very important. Sometimes it is not important. I had assigned your reading the importance of bonding. Did you find that interesting? That is exceedingly important. They are finding, but let me summarize that. They are finding that children who are put in daycare centers very early do not bond to their parent, to the mother especially, and they find it later, they're finding it later on in life, they find it difficult to establish strong and lasting relationships with anybody. What children tend to do is to overcome the pain of separation from their mothers by turning off to outsiders, to anyone other than themselves. They simply desensitize themselves. And you cannot, once a child is turned off in that way, it's very hard to turn them back on. I've already talked about the requirements of time if a parent is to know the child. I talked about some children, the reluctant communicator and the passing opportunity. Did I not discuss that? Yes. But some children are very, you can get to know some children very easily. Other children takes a great deal of time. Okay, I think I've given all the time I need to on that. We come now to the proposition of respect for the child as a person. Get to know your children as people, not just as your children. There's a difference. Every child, first of all, needs to be an only child, quote, especially if they are not an only child. We've had four children, and we've learned that you need time alone with children to get them, because children tend to fade into the crowd if they're two or three or four children, the younger ones especially. The younger ones tend to get lost in the shuffle. And that's why it's very important to make every child an only child sometimes. Focus in on them. Secondly, we may attack what a child does, never what a child is. Remember we talked about making these minor distinctions? Well, this is a very important distinction, although it's a small one. It's one thing to attack what a child does. Something else to attack what a child is. Chaim Ganot does a good deal has written about this in regard to teenagers. It's one thing to say to a teenager, "Why are you such a slob?" Which tears them down. It's something else to say, "I get very angry when I tell you to clean up your room and you don't do it." A child recognizes that's legitimate. You can be very angry about what a child does. For instance,
I can remember shouting at my children, raising my hand. There's nothing wrong with shouting. Sometimes very effective. Not all the time, of course. I said to a son not too long ago, do you know how hard it is on me to be ignored? I just can't hardly stand being ignored. It's tough on me. I have a hard time dealing with being ignored. Well, that's legitimate. A child recognizes that because a father has a legitimate interest in not being ignored. Something else to say to a child, why did we ever have you? Sorry we ever had you. Listen, parents say this. I wish I were making that up. You're never going to amount to anything. Doesn't matter what I tell you, you're just going to do what you're going to do, and that's just the way you are. No, that's not. Don't tear down what a child. Also, never step on it. I'm reading now. Never step on what a child thinks or says. Never step on it. Don't have to agree with it. It's one thing to disagree with what a child says. It's something else to step on him or to step on it. Now, we see little children like this. Little children bring you, they've been coloring. They're just starting out, you know, and they bring you this something with 16 different colors in. They say, look, Daddy, what do you say? Well, you don't be ridiculous about it. You don't say, well, I can see you're going to be another Rembrandt, or that's the finest piece of art I've ever seen in my life. No. But you don't say, what is it? Or you don't say, that's an interesting giraffe, and then the child will say, but I was drawing Grandma. What you say is, my, you worked hard on that, didn't you? Or something like that. Boy, you worked hard on that, didn't you? Yeah, well, you see, you're recognizing their effort. You don't have to commit yourself to anything. You don't have to put it down. You don't say, don't bother me, or what is it? When they get older, you get this at the meal table. You know, eat your spinach, but I don't like spinach. Of course you like spinach. Everybody likes spinach. Don't be so dumb. No, I thought I didn't. Last time I ate it, I puked. And sort of led me to believe I don't like it. You know. No. You say, well, I understand. There's some things I don't like. But in a family like this, we try to eat whatever's on the table. Or child says, I don't want to go to bed. Now, don't be so silly. Don't act stupid. Of course you're going to, it's time to go to bed. You know, it's because we got company. Don't get any ideas. Parents talk like that. You don't say that. You say to a child, I can see why you'd want to stay up. This worked. If I were you, I'd want to stay up too. We've got company, and you'd like to stay up and be with us, wouldn't you? Yes. And I wish you could. But you have school tomorrow, and you know how you have to get up early, and so we'll give you another 10 minutes, and then you're in bed. Kid still goes to bed, but at least he's not made to feel like a criminal or an idiot for wanting to go to bed. You understand? It's one thing to have to go to bed when you got company and you'd like to be up. It's something else to go to bed stupid and ridiculed. Uh-huh. So you can say, well, yeah, I can see how you'd feel that way. I wish you could. I'm on your side. I really wish you could. But you know how it works. This is what we have to do. A kid will buy it. You understand? And so if a child thinks something, it's one thing to disagree. It's something else to step on the child or step on what they think. Listen, if you convey to a little child that you don't really care, that what they think is not important to you, then you're going to find the day is going to come. It's going to come about with puberty. When they will let you know that what you think isn't important to them, and you turn them off, I promise you one thing, they'll turn you off. But you show an interest in what they think, and they'll always be interested in what you think. I think one of the greatest compliments you can pay to a small child, ask him what he thinks about something. Not that you have to do it his way. You're out making. I can remember. I'd be out making something, building something, and I'd ask a little toddler, a little child there, maybe not a toddler, 5 or 6 years old, say, what do you think about this, Adam? How would you do this? You know, tell me what he thinks. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you better do what you're going to do anyway. But the kid feels like he's something. We must allow respect for the child as a person. This is very important. You understand? Just because he's your child does not mean he's not a person, has an independent existence. Okay, next, we're just taking these sort of potpourri of principles. Make Christianity fun in the home. Now, you may not agree with this, but listen to what I say anyway. Make Christianity fun in the home. Somebody raised the issue before, and I promise to discuss it here, the need for formal versus informal devotions. There are various approaches. One approach, some families work very well with formal devotions. That is, they have a set time, they read the scripture, they have maybe sing a song, and it works very well. It never did work in our house. It may be because I was preaching, and I am a preacher, and was in the local ministry then, and I kind of felt that the kids heard me speak two or three times a week. They didn't need a miniature church service in the home. I didn't think that, so we never did have a lot of formal. Our meal times or our devotional times, we would usually sing. We still do. We're all there, and pray, and that became our prayer time. But so our devotional time was kind of informal. You understand? And I'm not holding for one or the other. I've seen families that had the formal time, and they worked very well for them. Every family has its own chemistry. What I teach here in the syllabus, and this is what I stress, whether you take the more formal or the less formal approach or something in between, the important thing is that Christianity must be a natural, mainstream aspect of daily family life. That is the issue. That's the key thing. It must be, understand, it must be just as natural as the cornflakes on the table for breakfast.
Oatmeal.
To make it natural. If you want to make it hard for your children to grow up to be Christians, then you just make Christianity an artificial add-on to your family life. I tell you, the kids know this. Understand? It must be just God must be just and our life of faith must be very natural. Must be a part of the flow. I recall. I had a weekend preaching ministry up in Northern Ohio when I was about my third year undergraduate school. We had this deacon in the church. I never did think he was much of a man of God. But I never could put my finger on anything. And one day, I was there for a year, and we just a long way to drive up there. He invited us over, my wife and I, over for the Sunday dinner. And he had a couple of boys, maybe three. So he said, "Preacher, would you have our prayer of thanks for the food?" And so I did. And when I said, "Amen," one of the little boys looked up at me and said, "We don't pray when you're not here." Feel about one embarrassed set of parents. Well, since that was the only time I'd ever been there, that was my first and last time, I wondered how often, I guess they don't have prayers for their meals too often. We don't pray when you're not here. Well, what that father was doing was sending a very clear signal to his children that Christianity is not real. It doesn't really count. Now, what do we mean make it natural? I mean, I think one of the key ways we do this is there are two ways in which Christianity becomes natural in the home. Number one is the Christian ethic, Christian standards are assumed. That we need to say in the home over and over, "We're Christians, we don't do this," or "We're Christians, we do this." This is very natural. We don't operate this way. This is the kind of thing, this is what we do. We're Christians. Now we go to church. We always go to church at our house. It's Sunday, it's not open for debate. The reason we go to church. We give our tithe, the simple things. Kids get their jobs. Lord gets his part. Understand? They just learn this is a natural part. Prayer. I think this is interesting. One of the best things you can do is pray with your children and teach your children that prayer is their privilege and it's a natural part of life. I can remember many times going by the door down the hall and seeing my wife on her knees with the kid who's facing a rough day. Trying out for something, you got exams. Just tell a kid to pray about it. Just pray about it. And understand and talk. We must teach our children that talking to God is just as natural as talking to each other. And we talk about. I need to talk about an answered prayer. Do you believe God answers prayers? Well, if you pray, he will. It's a family joke at our house. My wife has an amazing. If you want to get your one of your prayers answered, you ask my wife. If you have a real need, I'm serious. You ask my wife to pray for you. She has an insight. She and God have got something going. I mean, she's got an inside track, and the kids know. The kids know this. It bothers me because I'm the natural spiritual leader of the home, and yet when they'll talk over with mom, get her to, because she's been there so much, has spent so many more hundred hours with them, that she has prayed with them more often simply because she's there. And I remember one time we were having a family discussion. We were talking about some very specific things where God had answered prayer, and my oldest son said in jest, "Well, Mom, while you're on a roll, Maserati would be nice." But we didn't pray for a Maserati, but she was on. We were talking about how God had it. Do your children expect God to answer their prayers? Is it just natural? That's the important thing. And I recommend the light touch. I tell you, I don't like this heavy-handed devotional life. I think in our modern culture, you're working against it. Make Christianity fun and natural. I mean fun. Well, listen, is God a liberating force in your family, or is he an oppressive and oppressive force? It's one thing to have strong standard. It's something else to make God and faith oppressive. And some families do it. Yes.
What do you think about like a prayer box for your children? But when they're old enough to write something, they can write the prayers down and date them, and then every once in a while go through them and then take out the ones that God has answered, and so they can.
That's an excellent approach. That's a little more systematic, yes, and children need to know that God answers prayer. Just recently, I'll give you an example. My youngest son had his bicycle stolen. And it was an expensive bike. I bought him a year ago, and somebody had seen him riding it, and he had really taken care of it. And, he needed it. He used his bike a lot every day. And so somebody stole his bike a couple of weekends ago. And a week later, somebody heard about it and gave him a bike that was exactly like his, only a little fancier. And he got a better one. Somebody had a bike they weren't going to use, and heard that a friend of ours is going to sit there, and they heard that his had been stolen. So they came by a week later and gave him a new bike. And I said to him, Adam taught me, I said, Adam said, well, God knew I needed my bike. You think that's true? You think God knew that a boy needed his bike? I think so. I can't prove it, but I don't have to. Understand? I think I'm God, and understand, to him it's very natural. I needed the bike, and God knew your mind was taken, and so I got another bike. Now he locked it up. He went out and bought a lock to make sure that Satan didn't get his hand in it again. But you see that? I think it's very natural. Well, that's the important thing. Okay, now we come on. You stop me if you want to. We come on now because we need to make time. We come on now to traditions. The articulated concept of family. I recommend this, that you think family, talk family. You provide security for your children by this. We're a family. We do family things. We have family night. We take care of each other because we're part of a family. Family, family, family. Children love to be a part of a family. If you have a good family, you have other kids showing up to be, try to be a part of your family. Because they want family. And they understand, and it gives them a sense of identity and security. I'm a part of this family. In this family, we take care of each other. This is how it, and kids love to say this. Our family does this. Don't you feel like you kids love to go home when they've got a good family? Well, it's good to be home, be with the family. Yes?
When you first got married, did you live near your relatives?
No.
Well, when you live near your relatives, you have to decide when do you go
you have to go this one for this when do you break away from
that? That's an excellent question. You see what he's asking? Especially comes when do you break away from grandma and establish your own family? You make that the center. This is especially true important around holidays. For instance, where do you spend Christmas? And it's an excellent question. And because when you first married, we lived about 100 and over 100 miles from either one of our parents during the early years of our marriage. And when you're first married, what do you do for Christmas? You go home, if you can. Yeah. And then you take turns. One Christmas you go to one set of in-laws, another Christmas another. That's if they're both available. And that worked out fine. But then we were married 3 years before we had our first child. Then you get the first child, and when they're still infants, very small, you take them. But when do you draw the line, you see? And I remember, and my wife, her family, always Christmas was a very precious time when she was growing up in her family, a very special time, as it is in ours. We love Christmas. In fact, we go a little bit crazy around Christmas. But we always enjoy going back to her family and being a part of that circle. When our children begin to be old enough, I had to say to my, when they get to old enough to know, I would say, I'm just guessing, 3 or 4, I don't know, maybe 2, maybe earlier. I said to her 1 year, and she just hadn't thought about it. I said, we're going to stay home this year. We're having our family at home, or at least we may go Christmas Day, we may go to Grandma's, but we're having Christmas Eve and Christmas morning at our house. Well, why? And I said to her, just remind her, do you remember all the good memories you had being a child in your parents' home on Christmas? Well, our children are going to need the same thing. They got to write, and she agreed with me. And so from that time on, we had almost every year, maybe every year, I don't recall, we had our own Christmas, and then maybe like on Christmas Day we'd go over to see Grandma, or the day after, or go for New Year's or something. You understand? Because our children had the right to have their own memories, and then you sort of develop your own. And that's the natural time, I think. But there are other times. But it depends on a lot of circumstances. But your principle is right. You see what he's asking? There comes a time when you have to make the center of things your own family. Now some people, married couples, some mates, especially husbands, get jealous. It's an interesting thing. If you marry a woman or a man, if your mate has a good family, that will tend to be very important to them. And it's very easy to get jealous of that. And you have to watch that, because that's deadly to a marriage. And you have it's hard to strike a balance between the two. That is, when do you go to mom and dad's house and when do you not? And then, of course, this idea. Listen, the in-law problem is a lot of jokes made about it. It can be a real problem. So you need to strike a balance. And what that balance is depends on a lot of factors. Very complicated. But I know that my son-in-law, his father died a couple of years, a year or so before he married my daughter. And he had a nice family. But around Christmas time, our family, things really get intense. I mean, we really have a time at Christmas. And he spent a year ago last Christmas, he spent his first Christmas as a part of our group. He was crazy. He loved it. He couldn't wait. He thought it was the best weekend he ever spent. And we just had a ball. And now he's really looking. But not to say he doesn't enjoy it with his mother and sisters, but there's going to come that time when they're going to have their own children and have to start their own traditions. Okay, so we're talking about traditions now. We articulate the concept of family. What is the role of tradition? Security, identity, stability. Remember Fiddler on the Roof? Well, the Fiddler on the Roof is a metaphor for what? It's a metaphor. Life in for a Jew in so in Tsarist Russia was a very delicate thing. It was very hard to maintain your balance. To live as a Jew in Tsarist Russia was like a fiddler on a roof. He's trying to scratch out a tune without falling off. How do you live without falling off? Question. In the middle, what kept the fiddler on the roof? How was he able to?
Tradition.
Remember? Tradition. That's what keeps the fiddler on the roof. That's what keeps your life in balance. You maintain your identity as a Jew in Tsarist Russia by your traditions. Why do we do this? I don't know. But it's a, remember Rev Pevia? Why do we always wear our hats inside? Why do we always have the tassel? I don't know, but it's a tradition. And then he says this, traditions tell us what? Who we are and what God expects us to be. What God expects of us. Now that is very sound, traditions. Many traditions revolve around holidays. But there needs to be, traditions are very, you say, our family does this every New Year's. Our family has this tradition. And they can be the big things and little things, but it gives a sense of identity, stability, and security. And you need to develop your own tradition. Sometimes you inherit traditions. Sometimes you develop your own. And children, oh, they look forward to this. It gives, I'll give you an example of a tradition. And often they rob on holidays. When our children were little, Christmas Eve began to be chaotic because our kids would get the Kane Hardleys. You know, they spent all day Christmas Eve wrapping the last presents and baking the cookies and getting everything ready. And the kids were fussing, you know, waiting for Santa Claus to come. And a hard time of waiting is hard on little kids. And then we get up for Christmas morning, open the presents, and then we usually go to Grandma's for Christmas lunch or supper. And the kids were just a mess. So one year, very early, I said to my wife, we're going to do something. We're going to form a tradition. Next year, I said, we're going to do this. We're going to get everything done the day before Christmas Eve. Get all the presents wrapped, all the cookies made, and we did. Everything was done before Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve morning, we're going to get up, and we're going to say, that's going to be our day, our family day. We share Christmas Day with Grandma. Christmas Eve is going to be our day, Grandma and Grandpa. Be our day. So we, for years, it's a tradition. We get up and kids get up and we leave the house. We go out for a brunch, and then we had do something special in the afternoon. One year we went to see the Nutcracker, the Cincinnati Ballet Company. That was a little expense. That was a part of our Christmas. My kids never forgot that. We go see movies, all the Christmas family movies on. One time we saw The Sound of Music on a wide screen. There were 12 people in the theater, and we were 6 of them. Well, we had a ball. We just spread out right in the middle of this thing and talk, you know, enjoyed it. Everybody else was doing what we used to do. We'd go into, it's not true down here, but we'd go into restaurants, have it to ourselves. Why? Everybody was out getting their last minute shopping. We'd go through the shopping mall, see the decorations, and then the evening we'd go home, get home about 9 o'clock that night and make fondue, Christmas Eve tradition. Sometimes cheese and meat and bread, sometimes chocolate. You know what fondue is? We'd have fondue. And it worked out great. We'd had a family day together. The kids were tired. They hadn't sat around fishing it all day. We put them to bed. And we still do this. It's still our. Now, when we moved to Florida and the kids get older, our tradition, we understand? Everything's done. Christmas Eve, that's our family day. And we always go to breakfast at the top of the world down here at Disney at the Contemporary Hotel, that buffet. That's a buffet. So every Christmas Eve morning, we go out and we start there. Then we spend the day together just running around. And at night, do a number of things. At night, we go home and make fondue. And I tell you, kid, if you think that doesn't get into kids' blood, you try changing it. You do it 3 or 4 years and try changing it. It's almost like assaulting heaven. You know, it's almost a sin. But you understand, things like that give children a sense of identity. This is what we do. This is who we are. Now, I just give that as an example. You create traditions. And sometimes these traditions are family jokes. Like, we got a box that that gets packed, that gets, you know, within families changing gifts. The question is, who's going to get the Reebok box? It's just a shoe box. I mean, at birthdays, some birthday present will come wrapped in. At Christmas, it's always somebody's. And so it's always a big thing. You know, it's a joke here. Where's that box going to turn up? Who's going to get it? You know, it's kind of an honor.
We got a Christmas card that's been around about the last 10 years. You never know who the family's going to get.
Another tradition we've got on Christmas is that I've always traveled a lot, and wherever I go, I pick up Christmas tree ornaments, and then the kids have made them over the years, and we've given them as gifts, and we can almost trace our whole family history on the Christmas tree ornaments. You know, this one was made, we got the ones the little kids made in school, have been given to them by their, you know, engraved, gold-plated, engraved by their parents, things I picked up in Bethlehem. And do you remember this? And so when we decorate the tree, that's always a big time. When we get out that box of the ornaments, and as the kids get the ornaments out, we just sort of recall our family history, parts of it, by the decorations. Well, that's important to kids. It's important to me. I'm the biggest kid of all. I love it. You know, I think it's great.
It's going to be hard for you when Angela.
Yes, it's going to be very hard. It's going to be very hard.
My grandmother was quick to say, man, I thought this day would never come. She verbalized that we quit coming over to her house. But I just
no, we don't feel that way. But
I wonder if she really felt that way or she was just saying that for our sake.
I don't know. But I have. We'll have to recognize that they have a right. Their children have a right to the same thing. Some in-laws can get very, very possessive and without meaning to. Okay, let's move on. Take time to play. Here's the rule. If we do not enter our child's world when he is young, we must not expect the child to enter our world when he is older. You play with your children. Play at their level. If your little boys invite you to play cowboys and Indians, you can't always do it, but you ought to do it once in a while. Why? Well, you know, do you realize what a great honor it is to be asked by a little boy to play cowboys and Indians with him? They don't ask this anybody. They don't just ask this any other little boy. My wife's mother, who's dead now, her grandchildren loved her. And one of the reasons they loved her, for many reasons, she's a great lady, and she is much missed. One of the reasons she was loved is that she entered the little children's world. When the kids were little, all the little cousins, they go to grandma's house for special times, and she'd have a tea party. She kept a whole box of old clothes, dress-up clothes, and she'd dress up the boys and the girls and give them names and make a little tea party, light a candle, make little pieces of toast, and they'd go outside and kind of knock on the front door and be let in and give their made-up names. She'd pour tea and talk with them, and they thought that even my kids' boys were too old for it. They were kind of disappointed Grandma wouldn't have a tea party. But she entered their world, and it became a great part of their growing up, Grandma's tea parties. Well, she didn't have time to do that, but she did it. She's entered their world. So here's the rule. Enter your children's world when they're little. If you don't expect them to enter your world when they get older. Wish I had more time to talk about that. A few quick things. Teach common courtesy in the home. Do you do that? Please, thank you. Just common courtesy. If they don't learn it in the home, they're going to learn anywhere. Make the home a happy place where the child is glad to be and to which he will want to bring his friends or her friends. Fun in the home. I've said this a number of times. Let me emphasize it here. I recommend the light touch. There's a great, you know, life is hard, and there's a lot of sorrow in life. And you need to, and the rule is, the life will furnish you all the misery you want. You have to manufacture your own joy very often. And I appoint every father or prospective father here, future father here, chairman of the joy committee. If there's no, the husband primarily will decide whether there's joy in the home or not. That's the way the thing is. If a father is an angry father, the mother cannot keep joy in the home. He'll take it out quicker than she can put it in. You understand? So it really depends upon the father. Is there joy in the home? Laughter. Jokes. Running jokes. Here's a rule for fathers. Can your children tease you? I ask that question when I'm teaching older couples, and I'll say, could you tease your father? And if they give answers, especially the men, almost everybody say, no, no. Well, something's wrong. Joy. You need to, you can get over a lot of rough spots with humor. And, well, there needs to be joy and laughter. If there's no laughter in your home, your kids will go to somebody else's house where they do laugh. sometimes at our house it borders on hilarity, especially when all the kids are home. LeAngela and Aaron are the two entertainers, and it really is. It gets funny. We had a rule at our house. I'll give you an example. One of my jobs as father is I have to pinch everybody's buns in the morning to get them moving for the day. All the guys around pinch their bottom. I forget sometimes. Most of the time, I don't forget. Here comes Daddy, pinch your bottom, get you going. They say, Daddy, leave me alone. Now I say, son, sorry to do this, but it's a rotten job. Somebody's got to do it. I have my responsibilities. Sometimes it takes me 4 or 5 minutes to catch them and get it done. We have a good time. The problem is I have to lock the door when I shave now, because they started doing it back, and it's very dangerous to get pinched when you're, I almost lost my nose one time. At our house, when you're taking a shower, you never know if you're going to get a glass of cold water over the top of the shower. It's very exciting to take a shower at our house. Also dangerous. You sort of take quick showers, and everybody learns you lock the door. I remember from the time we were having a picnic out by the pool, and it started out with my child saying to the father, you wouldn't dare throw me in the pool. It ended up with the whole family being in the pool. And the kids still remember that. Is there fun? I would feel very sorry for you if you grew up in a home where there was no fun. Well, make the home a happy place. You can. You better. Teach responsibility in the home. This is where it has to be taught. What's responsibility? Daddy, I give an example now. Okay, this is from real life. Daddy, I want to go. My friend just called up. We want to go play tennis. Well, you promised Mrs. Jones, that's her name, believe it or not, next door that you'd mow their grass this afternoon. They're counting on it. Well, I can mow it tomorrow. But you told them you'd mow it today. What do you do? Son, whether you play tennis or not, you told them you'd mow it today, they're expecting it. You keep your word. You do what's expected of you. You fulfill your responsibilities. You are responsible. For instance, here's an example. People understand this. My oldest son, who doesn't normally do it, mowed our neighbor's yard this weekend. A neighbor came over. Neighbor came over Saturday night to pay Aaron, and he said this. I would appreciate it. He said it was so nice to come home and find it all done. He said, I know one thing. If Aaron says he's going to do it, it will be done. Says he's going to do it. That's a real compliment. This man, by the way, pays up. This man has hired Aaron. He's had a job anytime he wants, working in his warehouse. They learn, understand? They learn. These kids are responsible. If they say they're going to do it, they'll do it. Why? But you have to teach them that. It's hard sometimes. Let me give you, sort of tie two things together. I think you ought to teach your kids that they're responsible for their own happiness. Some kids will try to make their parents responsible. Entertain me. And some kids are like that. And I had two kids, which two they were. And boy, I had to jerk a knot in their tail. Say, look, you are responsible for your own happiness. Don't expect us to keep cheering you up. They want to, you know, they want to mope all the time until you just work and work. Now, sometimes the child is down. You got to lift them up, but not every day. You're responsible. Or you say like say things like this. A child says, why didn't you get that assignment done? Well, I had to go out of class for a yearbook project, and the teacher didn't give me the assignment. What do? You call up the teacher and bawl them out? Other parents do. So didn't you notice my kid wasn't in there when you gave the assignment? Why didn't you make sure he got it? That's silly. You get you line the child and say, look, you are responsible. You knew a test was coming. You know how this thing works. You take responsibility. Well, they get in a fight. But Daddy, he said this to me. Look, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about you. You are responsible for your attitude. Regardless of how, you understand? Teach your children this. Regardless of how anybody else treats you, you are responsible for being what you're going to be. If you're a jerk, it's your responsibility. And if you're going to be a man, you're going to be a lady, you take responsibility for your own life. Otherwise, you raise a kid who sings this song all their life. It's not my fault. And kids will sing that song if you let them. Not my, and I cannot stand that in somebody. Not my. It's always, we get students like this. It's never, no matter what happens, it's somebody else's fault. And if you want to raise a loser, you raise kids who are permitted all their life to blame it on everybody else. The rule at our house is, it's your life, you take responsibility. I don't care what anybody else does, you are responsible. You take responsibility. What do you do when a kid says, we've had generally good experience with public school teachers, almost always a good experience, but we've had a couple of bad experiences. And we had one teacher that was really a bad teacher and really turned kids off. It wasn't just our kids. What do? Do you let a kid know, okay, you're not responsible for doing good work because that's a bad teacher? Oh, no. You say, look, I don't care what kind of teacher it is, you are responsible for getting it done. Kids need to know this. You understand? You teach them to take responsibility. If you say you're going to do something, you do it. You follow through. Yes?
You kind of just integrate the responsibilities around the home at certain ages that just seem natural, like lawn mowing for me. I mean, that was just a natural thing. I mean, yeah. I wanted to go out there, you know, hang on to the bar, yeah, and then push me around. But as far as dishes and stuff like that, I mean, is there a set age or does that just come like that?
It comes naturally. And some that's more important to some homes than others. I know a father once who would not buy a dishwasher because he thought he was raised, had to wash dishes, he thought it was good for his kids. Now I think that's silly. That's just a matter of opinion. Why? Well, there are more important things in life. You know, I'll let my wife, we'll get a dishwasher. But it's like, you get to have a family dinner. Everybody picks their own plate up. Takes it back to the kitchen. You know, simple response. It's simple things sometimes. The idea, for instance, they'll say, here's an example. Mom, I wanted to wear this shirt tonight. It's not ironed. Did you tell me you wanted it? Did you tell me? Well, no. Then you're responsible. You don't tell me ahead of time, iron it yourself. Or, did you get it in the wash? Well, no. Where was it? Under the bed. You understand? It stays under the bed until all of a sudden they realize they want to wear it on a date, and they put it in. Then then they blame it on the mother. What does the mother do? The mother tells them very clearly that it was your shirt. You knew what you were gonna, and what you were gonna do. If you wanted it washed, you should have got it in the wash. You're responsible. That's one of the most important things you can teach children. Oh, listen. It'll pay dividends all their life. Be aware of a couple more things. Next hour, we're going to talk about sex. That'll You can bring your guests to the class if you want to. What do you? How do you give your kids sex education? This is very important. Well, before we come to it, a couple of minor points. Be aware of special problems that come with the onset of puberty. Kids, junior high kids, are the worst, are hard to raise, some of them. It's a hard time for junior high students. Why? They're neither fish nor fowl. First place, the girls are ahead of the boys, and the boys are humiliated. You ever go to junior high camp where the girls are always 2 years older than the boys, although the same chronological age? You've got girls who are young ladies and boys who are still little boys in the same camp. If you get one boy who's... We used to have... I know this camp down here. I don't know why they permitted it. You always had one or two high school boys that would go back to junior high camp. Just to go to camp, because they could... All the girls would gravitate toward them, and the little old junior high boys, you know, were standing around looking stupid. And junior high, puberty is tough on kids. Their body changes, their voice changes, their attitudes change. One day they want to be children, the next day they want to be adults. It takes a great deal of patience to raise junior high kids without killing them. My youngest is through it now, and I've had four through it, and but some go through quickly. LeAngela went through that puberty state, seemed like in 6 weeks. I swear it took Leslie 5 years. No, that took LeAngela longer, it didn't take Leslie that long, but it seemed that way. Junior high age, it's a tough time. And I don't have time to go into that. I'm sure Professor Bundy has some very specific teaching on that in some of his classes. Be aware of the special problems, last of all, involved in living with a teenager. Now, let me say this. I love teenagers. I like mine. What's going to be one of the sad days of my life when I run out of teenagers. I like other people's teenagers. Most of them. Generally speaking, I've liked the teenagers that my kids have brought around. I like having a house full of teenagers. Teenagers are exciting. But teenagers are a special kind of animal. A child changes. A teenager is a very important years. They're formative years. They change rapidly. They grow up. I said to my oldest son last night, son,